Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, what's life like in Baghdad as ISIS continues its relentless campaign against civilians there?
But first, there are just 6 days left until the midterm elections here in this country, and it does appear in a number of races that the GOP has the edge and may well take control of the U.S. Senate. So if that happens, what will the Republican agenda be? Joining us from Washington is Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming. He's the chairman of the Senate Republican Policy Committee. Senator Barrasso, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy.
Well, what are your predictions for Tuesday? Do you think that the GOP is going to retake control of the Senate?
Well, I'm very optimistic, but obviously it's a long way away. I just think we have many more avenues to get to the 6 seats that we need. So I continue to be optimistic. And I think it's important because I believe that a Republican Senate's the only way that Washington's going to actually be able to get anything done for the American people and break through the amount of gridlock that's been out there.
Well, what would you like to get done as Republicans if you do take control of the Senate and retain control of the House?
Well, you make a good point about the House, Jeremy, because there are many bills that have passed the House with bipartisan support, and I know that we can get a number of Democrats to vote for those as well in the Senate if we could just get them up for a vote. Approving liquefied natural gas exports. 46 Democrats voted for that in the House. Either delaying or eliminating the employer mandate of the health care law, which is making it harder for people to hire others. So there's support for that. Patent reform legislation, 130 Democrats in the House have voted for that. Exempting veterans from the Obamacare mandates in certain conditions. There's huge support from both sides of the aisle.
But so that's President Obama would never sign on to a change like that to his health care law, would he?
Well, I think the president needs to take a look at some of the parts of the health care law which are doing significant damage to people all across the country. And while the president, I wouldn't expect to sign on to repealing the whole health care law, you know, I think we should be focusing on parts of the health care law that have been hurting patients as well as providers, as well as our economy, and then systematically stripping away the very worst pieces of the health care law.
So you're not talking about trying again to repeal the health care law if Republicans have control of both houses of Congress?
In terms of the things that I want to see put on the president's desk, I want to systematically strip away the very worst parts of Obamacare that have hurt patients, have hurt providers, and have hurt our economy. And the 30-hour work week regulations have been harmful to school districts, to teachers, to take-home pay, and there's bipartisan support to removing that. There's bipartisan support on the employer mandate on health care and to eliminating or delaying those components.
But not a repeal.
Well, I would imagine there will be a vote on repeal, but let's be realistic. Barack Obama is still going to be in the White House for another 2 years, and he is not going to sign that. I want to put things on his desk that he would actually give true consideration to signing because they're good for our economy, they'll get people working again, and they'll help move the country forward.
Senator, I noticed one thing you didn't bring up is immigration reform. What are the GOP's plans for immigration reform if you take control of the Senate?
Well, you know, the immigration bill has actually passed the Senate. It was a bipartisan bill. The bill is now in the House. I think we need to modernize our immigration laws and do that in a way, in a step-by-step fashion. When we try to put together some big comprehensive bill, there are all sorts of problems. We saw that with health care law, with all of the unintended consequences, even the Democrats are admitting have hurt in terms of providing health care for people. And I think you should do the same thing with immigration in a step-by-step, piece-by-piece votes rather than a large, comprehensive piece of legislation. But we do need to do immigration reform.
Would that include a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million people in this country illegally?
Well, you know, I voted against that in the Senate. Each member will make their own decision. But I imagine there needs to be a vote on various components of an immigration bill.
What about a higher minimum wage? Is that something, because that is popular among the American public, is that something that the GOP would put on their to-do list?
You know, at this point, the Congressional Budget Office has said it's going to cost $500,000 to 1 million jobs across the country. And I think the best story that I've heard about it was written about in the New York Times, where a woman from Idaho drove across the border into Oregon to work because the minimum wage was higher. She was making more money. And she said, of course, I had to work a lot harder. And she's a waitress. She said, I had to do the dishes. And they say, I said, why about that? And she said, well, that because they had to pay us a higher minimum wage, they had to fire the dishwasher. So for every person that may have an opportunity to make more money, you worry about that person that may lose their job because of the expense of the added cost of raising the minimum wage.
So that sounds like a no on putting the minimum wage on the to-do list for the GOP.
That is something that I've opposed, and I think others have as well.
Senator, one more thing I want to ask you about, and that is climate change. If the Republicans take control of the Senate, the next chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee would be James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who has called global warming a hoax.
The issue of climate change, of course, the climate continues to change. You have to look at what is economically feasible in terms of energy as well as in terms of the environment. I believe we can have energy security, as well as environmental stewardship, and focus on the economy at the same time. You have to realize that emissions from the United States are actually going down, but they're going up in China and in India. So any response that the United States does hurts our economy, puts us at a competitive disadvantage globally. And when you look at how Russia continues to use its energy as a geopolitical weapon, I think we ought to be using our energy as a geopolitical weapon as well.
But would it be the message of the GOP that global warming is a hoax?
It's the message of the GOP that we can have energy security, economic growth, and environmental stewardship together, working together in a way to protect our environment responsibly, while not hurting our economy at the same time. And the regulations that the EPA has been putting out are such that they have huge economic consequences for our country with very little, if any, environmental impact or improvement. In terms of long term, I think it's wrong to try to mislead the American people that we could run our economy with windmills and solar panels at a time that even 15, 20 years from now, by the most optimistic proposals, only 9% of American energy will be from wind and solar. So we need to use our energy efficiently and effectively, doing it responsibly without hurting our economy at the same time.
John Barrasso, Republican senator from Wyoming. He's also the chair of the Republican Policy Committee in the Senate. Thank you so much, Senator.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And an update on ISIS now. While the fight against ISIS continues in Syria, ISIS, the Sunni military group, has carried out a deadly series of attacks against Shia in Iraq. More than 100 people were killed in that country just this week, 30 of them today in western Iraq, where militants lined them up and shot them. Just the latest mass killings carried out by ISIS. Militants have also launched attacks against the capital, in neighborhoods, and mosques in Baghdad. West of the capital, Iraqi security forces claim they've been able to stop the advance of ISIS fighters, but those fighters have their sights set on the city's airport. Well, the BBC's Andrew Hoskin reports on what life is like in Baghdad.
It's the start of Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, and here at the Al Zora amusement park and zoo in central Baghdad, families are enjoying the start of the holiday. Mums and dads are here with their children, enjoying the rides and the sights and the candy floss, and above all, that elusive feeling of normality. For years now, the people of Baghdad have endured daily attacks, suicide bombings, car bombs, improvised explosive devices or IEDs. Al Zora is a rare safety valve in a pressure cooker of a city, as one father of two, Basim Al Sali, made clear to me.
Frankly, I don't care about Islamic State or ISIS, whatever they are called, or the terrorism. And God willing, we will destroy them. Anyway, we are here to enjoy ourselves, not talk about ISIS.
But many families I spoke to here admitted they were living in fear. I met Haitham Amir, a father of three, who works in Iraq's oil ministry.
The situation is very bad, you know.
Is it the threat that they are coming here from outside?
No, I think they will not come here.
Are you more worried about the threat inside Baghdad, the car bombs and the suicide bombings? Is that what worries you?
Right. From bombs, from suicide, yeah. Right.
Meanwhile, around 45 miles west of Baghdad, Iraqi armed forces and militia volunteers claim to have prevented IS from capturing the strategically important town of Amiriat al-Fallujah and caused the militants heavy losses. Ali al-Alak is an MP in the governing bloc and a close associate of Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi.
Baghdad is very secured now, and the situation is sort of good. And the Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has intelligent information about the security of Baghdad, and even ISIS are now going back to their areas farther than Baghdad.
Security officials here insist they're doing all they can to keep Baghdad safe from the insurgents. Major General Sadman is chief spokesman for the Iraqi Interior Ministry.
ISIS, they are aware that it is impossible for them to be inside Baghdad or to conquer or to control one area from Baghdad. Therefore, they are focusing on targeting innocent people by bombing, by suiciders. This thing coming from so many reasons. One of them, they are aware that there is an American aid and there is a help from the global system. And the moment they saw that there is emphasizing and there is focusing from the global system to help Iraq, they are trying to show off and trying to do whatever they have in their hands.
All of which is little comfort to father and husband Haitham Amir, who craves safety and normality for himself and his family.
How do you protect your family?
So we are living in our home only, and we are coming here just today in this park, but actually we are living in our home only.
The security situation within Baghdad looks certain to be bleak for some time to come and may even get worse. This weekend, IS has apparently made specific threats against Shia religious festivals planned for the forthcoming week.
The BBC's Andrew Hoskin in Baghdad. You're listening to Here and Now. There's news today that those 150 Kurdish Peshmerga fighters from Iraq have passed through Turkey, aiming to join Syrian Kurdish fighters to defend the town of Kobani against ISIS militants. The Turks are not sending their own ground troops because while Turks have a relationship with the Iraqi Kurds, they see the Syrian Kurds as siding with an insurgent Kurdish group in Turkey. So the Iraqi Kurds are crossing from Turkey into Syria. Also crossing the border, several brave journalists. NPR's Deborah Amos has been to Syria, as is Ivan Watson, CNN, and Holly Williams, an Australian working now for CBS, has crossed several times. You can see her reports at hereandnow.org as Holly joins us by cell phone from her home in Istanbul to open up her reporter's notebook. It's a rough phone line, but worth listening closely. Holly, good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
You've had some extraordinary reporting. Let's talk about some of the Kurdish fighters you've met. You spoke with a group of what you called a 40-person ragtag army, but among them, you met Kurdish female soldiers. Here's part of your interview with one of them, a 19-year-old.
ISIS has kidnapped women. We hear many reports of them raping women, of them forcing women to marry their commanders. Are you frightened about what might happen if you're captured? I'm not afraid, she told us. I'll blow myself up before I let them catch me.
Holly Williams, what was your sense of these Kurdish fighters and also your thoughts about seeing these women in full, you know, what appear to be khaki uniforms fighting alongside men?
Well, we wanted to go into that part of Syria, northeastern Syria, because we felt they had been undercovered. The Kurdish people of Syria are fighting against ISIS. And one of the most interesting aspects of that is that around a third of their fighters are women. And the big question in my head was whether they really were fighting, whether they were on the front lines, or whether it was, for want of a better expression, you know, window dressing. And really, that question was answered for us within about an hour of driving into Syria. We drove in from Iraq, and unfortunately our guide decided to take us down an unplanned road. We went much too close to the front line with ISIS. We went within about a mile of ISIS, and they started shooting at our convoy. And we took cover in a nearby village, which we found defended by Kurdish fighters.
We actually have some sound of that. Let's listen.
We get the QIG here to pick us up.
We took cover in a village of mud brick huts, where the shooting continued. ISIS has been attacking Mahmudin village for nearly a month. The militants are just a mile away, and most of the residents have fled.
Holly Williams, we could hear the... Were we hearing bullets or something whistling by?
We were. Some of it was incoming and some of it was outgoing. And that's been the situation there for weeks, if not months. The Kurdish fighters who we ran into, I mean, literally ran into as we took cover in that village of Mahmudin, have been there for, they said, weeks, essentially trading pot shots with the ISIS fighters who were in another village about a mile away. And as I was saying, one of the big questions in my head as I crossed over into Syria to meet these Kurdish fighters is whether the women were really on the front line. And that question was answered by that experience, because they were there defending that village, trading fire with ISIS.
Now, Holly, we want to ask you about your putting yourself on the front line as a journalist, but I know you want to talk more about what you saw. So what did you see? Are these towns completely empty except for the fighters?
Largely, that village was an Arab village. Remember that Arabs and Kurds have lived together in this area for centuries. And the situation with ISIS has forced many people to take sides. And in those Arab villages that are in areas that are largely controlled by the Kurds, people have decided either to take sides with the Kurds or they've left in many cases and moved into territory controlled by ISIS.
Well, you also had an extraordinary visit to a prison. Kurdish fighters took you to a prison where they said they were holding what they said were captured ISIS fighters, one, a 15-year-old who said he had been given drugs to go out and fight and that he'd do anything when he was on those drugs, even blow himself up. Another showed you his wounds. I noticed in that video that as soon as these prisoners were brought in the room, you went forward and touched them. You put your arm on them. They were blindfolded. What were you thinking in that moment?
I don't think I was thinking very much. It was just a very human reaction. And if I had been thinking, I may not have done that, because I hadn't spoken to the men yet. As it turned out, two of them denied any involvement with ISIS. But if they were, in fact, ISIS operatives, then they probably, many of them wouldn't have wanted to shake hands with a woman if they practice a conservative version of Islam. But they were being pushed into the room. They were blindfolded. They were reaching out in front of them, obviously didn't know where they were going or who they were about to meet. And so I reached out to guide them. One of the men who was shaking and apparently terrified didn't just take hold of my hand. He actually started to kiss my hand.
Yes.
And then sat down, still shaking, and put his hands up in front of his face.
Because they thought they might have been being led to be killed. They didn't know where they were going. It's quite a moment.
They said that they thought that they were going to be, two of them said that they thought that they were going to be beaten.
Well, you also came across an American, a former American serviceman who traveled to Syria to fight ISIS. You asked him if he killed anyone, and here's what he told you.
I've killed two. In my first battle in Jezza. That's it so far. Hopefully my numbers will go up. Never thought I'd be over in Syria killing people, but they've killed innocent people.
And Holly, he told you he was compelled to go because of video, like the video we've seen of journalists being decapitated. You asked him what would he do if he was captured by ISIS, having seen those videos. He said if there was one bullet, I mean, this is tender stuff. He said, if there's one bullet, I would use it on myself. Look, this brings us to you. You are not just an American journalist in Syria. You're a female crossing over into Syria. You have a child. And you'd said a couple years ago that you would set some limits on going into Syria. What's your thinking now?
Oh, I still have those limits. And my decision to go into this part of Syria was, I think, very well thought through. It was several weeks in the planning. And that discussion involved not just fellow journalists at CBS, my producer, but also our security advisors who are ex-servicemen themselves. A lot of the things that we do seem more dangerous to our audience than they actually are. The most dangerous thing was that episode where I drove into Syrian Kurdistan with no intention to put ourselves in danger. And then, unfortunately, our guide took us too close to the front line. But I would stress that we were still a mile from ISIS positions. We would have had to be very, very unlucky for them to have hit us. So I absolutely have limits on what I'm willing to do. And a big part of that is that I have a young daughter.
Well, it's still pretty extraordinary to those of us watching. It's been terrific reporting, and I know you would want to say it's when you say we, there's a camera crew, there's producers, all taking these same risks. Holly Williams, CBS News correspondent based in Turkey on her reporting in Syria. For links to her reports, go to hereandnow.org. Holly, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I said American journalist, but again, she works for the American network, CBS. She is Australian.
Residents of Hawaii's Pahoa Village are feeling helpless today as hot lava from the Kilauea volcano on the Big Island begins burning buildings. Residents have evacuated their homes and can do no more than watch as the lava flows on. Janet Babb is with the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. She joins us from the summit of Kilauea. Janet, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And describe what's happening here, because this has been a very slow-moving process that's been going on for months now.
Correct. If we kind of back up, you know, Kilauea has been erupting for over 31 years now, but for much of that time, the lava flows have headed to the south and ultimately reached the ocean, and oftentimes not impacting any infrastructure. There have been previous times, in 1990, lava flows impacted the community of Kalapana. But what's different about this lava flow is that it is headed to the northeast of the vent rather than to the south, and is now nearing the community of Pahoa.
How quickly is it moving?
Well, presently, it's moving around 10 to 15 yards per hour. That varies greatly, though, depending on the topography. Other factors are the supply of lava, you know, being fed to the flow front by the lava tube.
And how hot is the lava?
Hawaiian lava flows are around 2,100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow. So they will damage or destroy anything they come in contact with.
Yes. Interestingly, let's say if a lava flow goes around a tree, it'll harden around that tree, so the tree doesn't just instantly burn through. But over time, the heat will penetrate, and typically it'll burn through the base, and then the tree will topple over onto the flow. But by the time it does that, the top of the flow is often hardened so that the tree just falls onto the hardened crust of the flow.
So what is going to stop this lava?
Well, unless the supply of lava is cut off from the vent, it will continue to flow.
Do we have any sense of when that might happen, or is that just something that will all of a sudden the supply of lava will stop?
Well, there's no indication. I mean, there have been changes throughout this eruption with different vent areas. But given the fact that this vent now has been active since June 27th, there's a very well-established lava tube carrying lava to the flow front. We don't see any indication of any dramatic change in the near future.
And in a worst-case scenario, how much property is in the way?
In addition to the lava flow moving through residential areas of Pahoa villages and businesses in the community, if it continues to go, it will eventually cross Highway 130, and that is a very critical road. It's the one road into and out of the lower Puna district on the island. The county has taken measures and set up alternative routes so that people can still get in and out of their communities, of their subdivisions where they live. But if the flow continues beyond Highway 130, it could ultimately cut both of those alternative routes.
And for people like you who are living and working on the Big Island, is this a surprise or is this something that's just part of life?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, it actually is part of life. We all we're living on active volcanoes, and so it is, you know, eruptions can be expected. But I think even though there have been many flows through the Puna district in the past, 1790, 1840, 1960, but I think we were all, you know, hopeful that it wouldn't happen in our lifetimes, that the flows would come back through this particular area.
That's Janet Babb, a spokesperson for the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, joining us from the observatory at the summit of Kilauea as this lava flow continues on the Big Island of Hawaii. Janet, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
A year ago this week, a new television network was born out of a union between ABC News and the Spanish language television channel Univision. They called it Fusion. We spoke with Fusion CEO Isaac Lee the day the new network launched.
We want to reach young millennials that consume media in a completely different way. We are going to do current events, news, pop culture, satire, but we're going to do it in a way that they can see the transparency, the honesty, the authenticity, and everything that we're going to do, it's going to have the adequate dose of humor. And that is a big change. Not everyone will get it, and I understand that. Sometimes I don't get it, but we are not doing this for me.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik recently visited the Fusion headquarters in Doral, Florida. He joins us with an update. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
Well, has Fusion been able to accomplish what Isaac Lee laid out on our program last year?
Well, look, there's tremendous energy down there. People seem very excited about this. And it's an experiment to have these two parent companies, as you mentioned, ABC, Disney, really, as the parent companies of ABC News and Univision, each of them quite successful on their own, coming together. Sometimes you think of bureaucracies coming together, as MSNBC was the product of Microsoft and NBC News. And that was a really awkward union. And here you see energy and drive and verve. That said, still very much a work in progress, still trying to build audience, still not rated by the Nielsen a ratings company because they haven't yet got a strong enough base and penetration in the country as a whole. So I think they're saying, hey, we're proud of the strides we've taken.
Well, give us a sense of what you found down there in Doral when you visited. The studios are in an old warehouse.
Yeah, well, it's an old warehouse, but it's an enormous one. It's in the flight path of Miami International Airport. So they've had to soundproof it. It cost over $100 million to construct, and it's glorious. It's digital. You're housing the operations of Univision's news shop in Miami, Spanish language, with those of Fusion itself, geared towards millennials. Particularly, I think it's important to stress, at least at its birth, Latino millennials, and you see that in terms of the subjects they cover. They oversee subscribe in news about Latin America, issues important to Latinos, issues important to everyone, but specifically Latinos like immigration, and a lot of emphasis on subjects like soccer that are particularly appealing. But you see this fusion, you see this intersection of interests. So Jorge Ramos, who's kind of the combination of Peter Jennings, Brian Williams, and Christian Amanpour when it comes to Univision and Spanish speakers in this country, he's the main anchor for Univision. You know, he takes the tie-off, he walks from one studio into another, and instead of speaking Spanish, suddenly he speaks in English to a younger audience with a slightly lighter touch. And that's kind of what they're doing. They're saying, look, this isn't your parents' Univision, and it's also not necessarily designed only to appear to Latinos, but somebody who's as trusted as Jorge is by Latinos is seeking to reach millennials, even as they also have a panoply of younger faces and voices as correspondents and anchors as well.
Well, and I actually asked Isaac Lee about that last year, about whether they were going after Hispanic millennials who speak English or millennials in general. Here's what he had to say.
Jeremy, we are trying to reach millennials. But what we're not going to do is ignore that 20% of millennials are of Hispanic descent, that they have a huge influence in culture, in society, in politics, in the economy. And the best way for us to reach Hispanic millennials as a core audience is to give them great content.
And David, we should point out that you can't always get Fusion depending on where you live and what cable provider you have.
That's right. It's only really available in about 20-some million homes in the country. And that's, there are over 100 million subscribers through cable and satellite and through online services to video and television products and channels. So they really haven't made the kind of penetration that they're going to need to have the collective consciousness that people will know this is a place I can turn every day. I think the World Cup was a signal moment for them. I think they showed real know-how and manpower, among other things, in covering the protests in Venezuela and protests in Brazil as well. So, they're trying to carve out areas areas of expertise. One of the things that, you know, I talked to at great length when I was in Florida with Jorge Ramos about is he expects not only Univision but Fusion to be a toll booth through which every candidate for president is going to have to pass if they're taken seriously, if they want to reach out to the Latino vote, they want to reach out to the youth vote, and they want to reach out to the young Latino vote that primarily gets its news in English.
Well, how likely is it, David, that by the next presidential election, 2016, that Fusion is still around?
Well, I think this is the great gamble that Univision and Disney have made. They've got a few years running room. They're going to have to prove themselves. Both corporations, particularly Disney, have proven themselves to be very bottom line minded, but also long-term focused. I think what they're looking to do here is one of the most interesting experiments we've seen in television in a very long time, perhaps since the emergence of Fox News in 1996. Whether or not it succeeds is really going to be a question of whether they both get the consciousness of possible viewers and also then the loyalty of those viewers. So a couple of years ahead, we'll know.
David, they have been hiring a lot of people. You mentioned Jorge Ramos, of course, who's very well known, but they've also been hiring people who are well known from other media organizations, from Reuters, from Vice, from Jezebel. Is the only way to make a TV network, a new TV network, work to bring in people that everyone already knows?
Well, you're talking about, I think, a stockpiling of an incredible amount of talent in the social media world, Felix Salmon, Margarita Noriega, and many others,
right,
who I think are trying to put Fusion on the map in the social media world as a way of, I guess, doing well by doing good. That is, by doing really good work, by doing stuff that's compelling, telling stories. You know, you think of people at Vox, 538 and others trying to tell stories graphically and visually. They're trying to figure out new ways to approach stories about politics or sport or foreign affairs or what have you in a way that works in the vernacular of social media and has credibility with younger viewers and consumers. And I think they see that as a sort of viral marketing technique as well as a way of doing solid but digital journalism.
When you say digital there, as you toured around this facility, does it look just like any other TV network, or was there something different about it, something about the fact that it really was born in 2013?
Well, look, it's very open spaced and it's very high tech and it's connected in all kinds of ways. They also use these enormous, seemingly sky high walls as the backdrops for their various studios. So if Univision happens to be filming, they have one logo kind of superimposed on one vast wall. And if Fusion's on the air, they might use another. And so the lighting and the color schemes and the logos can all change around. What I did see was just open space. Anybody can mingle the ideas that you can flag down people, even people from Univision flagging down people from Fusion and vice versa. And there's a young vibe there. You know, these aren't people, not all of them have been there for 30, 40 years. These are folks who are, they're trying to hire folks to bring new energy, whatever their age might be.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
One of our listeners, Dwight Lee Walter, pastor of the Congregational Church of Patchogue, Long Island, brought this next item to our attention, and we thought, given the news lately, you might also appreciate. Now, many churches have a blessing of the animals in October to celebrate St. Francis of Assisi. But this past Sunday, Pastor Walter held a blessing of the stuffed animals, and 83-year-old congregant Bill Powey was one who brought his.
My animal was given to my wife a year ago when she was temporarily at Momentum Nursing Home. And that's where she is now. She's dementia and can't be taken care of at home. And so this bear sits on her table next to where her chair is, where she always sat in the great room. We've been married 58 years. And so I'm living up to my vows now that I took all those years ago to sickness and health, and this is it. This guy is representative of that.
That being the stuffed animal. We just had to call Reverend Walter. Reverend, a blessing of the stuffed animals.
Those relationships that people have with stuffed animals can be just as real as the relationships they have with live animals or even with humans. Commitment, caring, and willingness to sacrifice. My daughter routinely would be sleeping on the floor because there was no room for her in the bed. Too many stuffed animals lined up shoulder to shoulder under the blankets with a pillow fluffed up behind their heads.
It's like the Velveteen Rabbit. So we heard from Bill Powey. Were you surprised that it was adults as well as children?
No, people hold on to these. I know women who've gotten rid of husbands, boyfriends, but they're not going to get rid of their stuffed animal. So I thought adults have these relationships also. And we had at least a dozen adults that showed up and about 40 children. One gentleman, his wife is experiencing memory loss. And that stuffed animal was a gift to him, and sometimes it stays in his home, and sometimes it stays with her in the nursing home, depending upon who needs it more.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it was a lovely day. Reverend Walter, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks as well to Charles Lane, who recorded that day for WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Stuffed animals, very important. I remember my Teddy Ruxpin when I was growing up.
Oh, you still have it.
From the Congregational Church of Patchogue now to the African-American Methodist community in the Mid-Atlantic. The singing and praying bands of Maryland and Delaware have been a key part of church life for generations, and they go back to the days of slavery. But the number of people participating has been shrinking. There's now just one singing and praying band left. It travels from church to church across the eastern shore of Maryland and coastal Delaware. Matthew Schwartz of WAMU, part of our Contributors Network, has the story.
It's not a choir. We do not have sopranos, tenors, altos, and bass. We just come together in unison and just sing on one accord and blend our voices together.
That's Reverend Jerry Colbert, leader of the singing and praying bands of Maryland and Delaware. And he's talking about a musical tradition that, until recently, hasn't been shared with outsiders. It has its roots in African ring shouts and has for years remained a relative secret. This wasn't about performing for others. This was about praising God, which makes this all the more surprising.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me present to you the 2014 National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellows.
Last month, the singing and praying bands received the highest honor the federal government can give a folk group. It came with prize money and a sold-out concert streamed live around the world. It's safe to say, the singing and praying bands of Maryland and Delaware are no longer a secret. Here's Reverend Colbert.
It's a constant prayer of, let us reach the people and how will they respond? We don't know if our message is getting across to them. We don't know if they consider us as entertainers and not a religious, spiritual organization. And so, we always have these thoughts going through our mind outside of the box at a festival at the Kennedy Center. Let's make sure that we're reaching somebody in that audience, in that theater.
You got to know something about the Lord in order to really enjoy the singing and praying band.
Sarah Irving is an energetic 79 going on 80. She lives in Cornersville, right outside Cambridge, Maryland, and she's been in this group for 60 years.
We don't have tambourines and band instruments. Our music is our hands. We sing with our lips and clap with our hands, stomp with our feet. When the Spirit get on us, we shout. And it's just a joy. It's just joy in singing and praying.
Doris Moloch, who also lives near Cambridge, has been in the group for longer than she can remember.
I pray, but I can't do too much singing. But when the Spirit get there, you know it. You know it. Everybody knows it. Yeah, nothing no better than that. Singing and praying. Praising God for keeping you from one day to another. And then he wakes you up and you see a brand new day. And God is good. For 81 years, I got something to praise and thank God for.
You think it keeps you young?
I don't know about that. But I know I'm still here. And I can still praise him, and I can still get around. I'm kind of slow, but they watch over me and take care of me. You know, I done lost 2 children. If God wasn't on my side, I couldn't make it. I tell you, I can't sing, but I can call on his name. And I get an answer sooner or later. Yeah. He'll come and see you.
The singing and praying bands are getting older. The members, as they might say, are coming home.
I'm not certain whether this particular tradition will survive.
That's Jonathan David, a folklorist who has studied the group for 30 years. He's in Philadelphia. We spoke on Skype.
I do think that this kind of recognition they're receiving now will change the singing and praying band, but offer new opportunities so that perhaps young people now may look at them in a different light. And be willing to join in and learn what the singing and praying bands have to say. But, you know, the African-American sacred music tradition is very rich, and I'm pretty secure in thinking that that will continue.
Even if you're not a member, even if you're not a believer, Reverend Colbert thinks anyone can take something away from hearing this group sing.
There is new life, and there is not a struggle always in life, and there's freedom in just singing. This thing about singing, it releases you. It becomes a part of you, you know, and it just takes you from where you are to another place. And we just hope that we reach somebody and say, man, that was wonderful, that was powerful, you know. I would like to hear them again.
For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Schwartz.
And that's it for this hour. Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. In association with the BBC World Service, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.